Welcome to the PRI Review, brought to you by the Population Research Institute. I'm your host, Christopher Mannion. Our friends in the European Union are going through a profound identity crisis. Slowly but surely, the demographic winter is creeping up on them like an early autumn blizzard, because the warm and sweet summertime of Christian Europe is long past. Europe's leaders are scratching their heads. Of course, they don't want to offend anybody, especially Muslims, homosexuals, and international elites. But they have no answer for the questions that are arising throughout what was formerly known as Christendom. Does Europe have a future at all? And if so, who will the future Europeans be? An inordinate number of today's Europeans have decided that whatever the future holds, it's not their problem. They simply aren't having any children at all. Many of their countrymen are tiptoeing towards the future, limiting their family size to the amazingly low capacity of most European apartments. One or two bedrooms, seldom three, no matter how large the family. And most European families, indeed, are not large. So when it comes right down to it, there are only two responses to this demographic reality. Either Europeans are going to have a lot more children, or they're going to stop other people from having theirs. In this regard, Europe's elites appear to assume that the Third World is as decadent as the European Union is. And so, having concluded that Europeans simply will not have more babies, and ignoring totally the massive influx of Muslim aliens that is intimidating Europe, Europe's governments, led by people still known as leaders, have decided massively to subsidize abortions in other countries where people are actually having babies. In short, Europe has declared war on the peoples of the Third World, aiming to abort children abroad so they will never have to deal with them there at home. An aborted potential immigrant is not an immigrant at all. In fact, he is dead, eliminated long before he becomes a problem. And for Europe's so-called leaders, other people's children are a big problem indeed. Let's start with France. Remember the French Revolution? Well, it's not over, as Chinese communist leader Zhou Enlai told Otto von Habsburg when standing on the Great Wall of China some 85 years ago. Our friend Mary Meany reports on LifeSite News that the French government is forbidding anybody, I'm quoting here, forbidding anybody from trying to convince women not to abort their unborn child. No information may be tendered on the internet or in counseling regarding potential negative consequences of abortion, she continues. The latter are considered lies, and if caught spreading them, one faces 2 years in prison and up to $37,000 in fines, end quote. Now, this is curious. Are the French trying to catch up with communist China's one or maybe two child policy? Or are they trying to do them one better by sending a message to France's potential mothers that it's better not to have any children at all? This is bad enough, but France is not alone. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau recently announced that Canada will spend $650 million in the next 3 years to increase access to abortion in developing countries. And PRI's own Jonathan Abamonte recently reported that Australia and Norway were joining in the fun, sending tens of millions to international abortionists to keep third world babies from seeing the light of day, lest they pollute the planet so beloved by the world controllers. Now, what is it that motivates such a public repudiation of basic human rights on the part of the world's self-anointed elites? One reason might be Donald Trump's victory in the 2016 presidential election and his promise to end U.S. government support of abortion worldwide. a direct reversal, and I might add repudiation, of the policies of Barack Obama and his Secretary of State, Hillary Rodham Clinton. In their presidential campaigns, both Obama and Clinton had the stalwart support of the international abortion industry, which in reality is merely a subset of the international population control monolith. So, on the face of it, the new funds coming from the world's pro-abortion leaders might be seen as simply a repudiation of Donald Trump. But there is more to this resentment than the extermination of third world babies. Indeed, the international left, unfortunately including many figures in the Vatican, resents not only Trump's policies, but Trump himself. The new president's opposition to American decline is in diametric opposition to the decline of Europe that is being fomented by the European Union's bureaucracy and its nominal leaders. In virtually every country in Europe, opponents of the destructive policies of the EU are becoming an increasingly important political community, against which the entrenched elites have no argument other than to scream, "Hitler!" and "We have to confront Russia!" With regard to the influx of millions of young Muslim males into every cranny of Europe, the EU's leaders are paralyzed. Turkish dictator Recep Erdogan threatens to send millions more into Europe if the EU does not grant him the privileges of EU membership, even as his Turkey sinks into the mire of the 21st century's largest dictatorial Muslim caliphate. Europe is dying at its core. The European Union confronts the Third World, not with the loving wave of a neighbor, but the savage brandishing of the curette of the abortionist. Its only answer to the challenges of international relations is death to third world babies. Oh, Europe's elites will fret about the perceived threat of Vladimir Putin in Russia, but the people of Europe have other concerns. They are aghast at the speed with which Christendom has been brought crashing down by secular internationalists, ravaging population controllers, and spineless bureaucrats who avert their gaze as the face of Europe is changed forever. Over 10 years ago, the European Union refused even to acknowledge Europe's Christian roots. And yet, one abiding truth persists, haunting the entire continent, and that is that a Christian West can triumph over any adversary. But a decadent secular West will collapse in the face of any opposition that is fueled by religious fervor, however misguided and perverted. This is PRI Review from Pop.org. When we come back, we'll have news from the Vatican. Do you want to win pro-life legislative and political battles? For years, PRI has been helping pro-life leaders on the ground around the world to win legislative and political battles in order to protect the lives of the unborn. And now we're asking for your help so we can continue this vital work. Let me tell you more. In a number of countries around the world, there are still pro-life laws on the books. But the Planned Parenthood abortion Uber Alles Malthusians are out there to get rid of those laws. Nearly 5 years ago, the Pontifical Council on the Family asked PRI to be the main organization to help the pro-life movements around the world to be more effective. In response to the Vatican's request, we created our pro-life victory seminars and our pro-life strategy guide. The seminars are grueling, demanding 12 to 14-hour intense working sessions. Only the most proven and successful leaders are invited to speak. Only the best and the most committed activists are invited to attend. To date, we have conducted 60 such sessions in 18 countries. We have trained more than 1,700 people who are serious about protecting the unborn in their respective countries. They have won some victories, but I'm not going to tell you about those because I don't want to put a target on the back of those leaders. I'm not going to tell you the names of their countries either because I don't want to make it even harder for them to do their work. But here's a hint. Most, though not all, have Spanish as their native tongue. It's no secret that south of our border, pro-abortionists are zeroing in on the existing pro-life laws in that part of the world. I cannot tell you the battle stories, although there are many, without endangering the victories of the leaders. I must ask you to take my word that some battles in some countries could not have been won without the training and support received from PRI. What kind of training am I talking about? Everywhere in the world, defenders of life need everything: strategic thinking skills, campaign skills, legislative skills, lobbying skills, to protect their pro-life laws and to stop pro-death initiatives. Around the world, we found that the biggest thing lacking is know-how. By that, I mean political sophistication. Here in America, we've been fighting pro-life battles for almost 50 years, and while we haven't won definitively, we have learned a lot about how to fight, as well as how not to fight. One of the most important tools of our pro-life victory training is the manual that the trainees get to take home with them, the Pro-Life Strategy Guide, the guide to winning pro-life battles. Think of it as a field guide to activism. The guide is a compendium of know-how. It is 200 pages of distilled experience and wisdom, with step-by-step instructions about how to advance our issue in a representative landscape. Here's a small sampling of the know-how delivered in these training sessions. How to raise money, how to lobby legislators, how to write powerful pro-life advertising, how to effectively appear on TV and radio, how to enlist volunteers, how to get out the vote, and how to successfully debate pro-abortionists. All this and much, much more is covered in the training program and reinforced in the training guide. The first edition came out in 2012, but we are all out of them now. They have all been put in the hands of able pro-life leaders. So today we have had it revised and updated by two of the best and most successful activists in the Spanish-speaking world. Today the new PRI, Pro-Life Strategy Guide, the guide to winning pro-life battles, is ready to go to press. This is where you come in. Will you help us get it into the hands of the people who need it? It's in Spanish right now, and that's as it should be, because we distribute it throughout the Spanish-speaking world. The Vatican wants this field manual in every diocese in the world. Will you help me to fulfill that request? PRI has ordered 10,000 copies of the guide to be printed, enough for every student who will attend our training sessions for the next several years, along with all the actively pro-life bishops around the world. Just the printing alone will cost $50,000. The whole International Victory Training Program costs another $50,000, and that is in addition to the field guide. But right now, we want to get those guides printed. So I turn to you because I know you understand its value. The cost comes out to about $5 per book, which is not very much considering the impact it can have and the lives it can save. With your tax-deductible gift of $50, PRI can put this guide into the hands of 10 in-country pro-life leaders. With a gift of $100, we can make sure that 10 friendly bishops get a copy to guide their strategic thinking in the protection of life. No gift is too small. If you can only spare $5, please send it today. Unborn babies around the world will be safer because of your sacrifice today. Can we count on you to help PRI to continue to train and empower the pro-life movement around the world? On behalf of all those fighting to preserve pro-life laws around the world, thank you. A A recent symposium at the Vatican was hosted by Archbishop Marcelo Sanchez Arondo, who has been crusading for left-wing causes ever since Pope Francis brought him to Rome from Argentina. PRI's Jonathan Abamonte reports. A recent symposium at the Vatican hosted by the Pontifical Academy of Sciences, PAS, and the Pontifical Academy of Social Sciences aimed at discussing the implications of biodiversity loss and finding ways to promote sustainable development. While Catholic teaching promotes stewardship of the environment, some of the participants invited to speak at the symposium have a history of promoting interventions directly contrary to Catholic teaching, such as contraception and population control. Among the more notorious controversial figures invited to participate at the Vatican workshop was none other than Stanford's Professor Paul Ehrlich, the world-famous author of The Population Bomb and longtime advocate of population control. The biggest problem we face is continual expansion of the human enterprise, Ehrlich said last week at Casina Pio Quarto, home of the PAS. And he continued, perpetual growth is the creed of the cancer cell. And we really have to look at the size of the human enterprise, end quote. According to United Nations Population Division data, however, fertility rates on average have declined considerably since the mid-1960s. The Population Division projects that world population is set to peak sometime around the end of this century. Far from being overpopulated, the entire world population could presently fit twice into Long Island. But we are already in a societal collapse, Ehrlich warns, when you get a diminishing marginal returns, end quote, by the way, on society's efforts to supply demand through increasing complexity, end quote. Well, Ehrlich cited the comparatively high profits made on oil drilling in Texas during the early part of the 20th century and the much lower per unit present-day returns made on extracting oil from the tar sands in Canada as a recent example of diminishing marginal returns. Ehrlich appeared to suggest that the same holds true not just for oil, but for resources generally. This goes across all of society, he says. While it may be true that Texas petroleum provided greater returns per unit of investment than the tar sands do, the example is not as readily applicable across all sectors of society as a whole as Ehrlich seems to imply. For one, the marginal return on oil can quickly increase if an easily accessible oil reserve is discovered, or if technology makes extraction cheaper. After the Texas oil fields started to go dry, vast reserves were subsequently discovered on the Arabian Peninsula, reserves that to this day continue to supply much of the world's petroleum. Certainly there will come a day when all our oil reserves will run dry, but humans are not simply consumers, but also innovators. And by the way, that day is very far off. But nonetheless, in The Population Bomb, Ehrlich predicted that humanity would outstrip its capacity to feed itself by the 1980s. That's not a misprint. The 1980s, resulting in mass starvation and famine. Well, as the 80s came and passed, Ehrlich's prediction was proven wrong, but far from the mass starvation prophesied by Ehrlich, undernourishment has actually proportionally decreased in recent decades. According to the United Nations, since 1990, even as the world population increased by 2 billion people, undernourishment dropped from 24% to 14% in developing countries, a huge number, significant change. Certainly, human dignity demands that we continue to reduce the prevalence of hunger in the world, but the point remains, significant progress has been made even as a world population has continued to grow considerably. While only 50 years ago it seemed impossible to many that the planet could support today's world population, human ingenuity has more than accounted for the gap. Crop yields have continued to increase predictably over the past decades and are higher today than they have ever been. According to data from the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, as of 2014, the world now grows 69% more food on only 28% more land than in 1961. In terms of annual average food production, there is more food available per person today than there has ever been before. And this is not just true for the world as a whole. A similar trend is also apparent when the data is restricted just to Africa. Now, the Vatican Symposium also counted among its participants John Bongaerts, Vice President and Distinguished Scholar at the Population Council, a well-known and widely regarded scholar whose research centers largely on promoting contraception and on studying the factors that affect fertility. Now, Bongaerts's research has also delved into abortion on occasion. Some years ago, Bongaerts wrote an article on the efficiency of menstrual regulation as a method of family planning. In it, he found that while it was not preferable to contraception, what he calls menstrual regulation appears to be a rational procedure under certain circumstances that should not be performed unless a positive pregnancy test has been obtained. Well, this means that if one is obtained, then the procedure is advisable. And menstrual regulation, of course, is simply a euphemism for a very early term, vacuum aspiration abortion. The Population Council is currently publicly opposing the Mexico City policy recently reinstated by President Trump. The Mexico City policy prevents millions of taxpayer dollars from subsidizing foreign non-governmental organizations that perform or promote abortion in other countries. The Catechism of the Catholic Church teaches that abortion is an excommunicable offense and, willed either as an ends or a means, is gravely contrary to the moral law. Likewise, the Catholic Church teaches that artificial contraception is not morally licit for the purpose of spacing or postponing births. Pope Paul VI, papal encyclical Humanae Vitae, states, and I quote, "The direct interruption of the generative process already begun are to be absolutely excluded as lawful means of regulating the number of children," end quote. Well, among the topics covered by Bongaerts in his presentation was the so-called unmet need for contraception, a semantic tool often used by contraception advocates to place a certain sense of urgency for ramping up contraceptive procurement in foreign aid programs. They confuse, of course, their desires with a universal need, which is very common in the pompous scholar that populates these programs today. Now, having an unmet need for contraception is roughly defined as women 15 to 49 years of age who are married or cohabiting, fecund, don't want a child within 2 years, and are not currently using a method of family planning. Using this definition, Bongaerts correctly cites the estimated proportion of women in the developing world having a so-called unmet need, but fails to mention that a significant percentage of these women don't even want contraception at all. In Kenya, for instance, the latest demographic and health survey, DHS, found that out of the 38% of women not using contraception who don't intend to do so in the future, only 0.2% of respondents cited cost or lack of access as the reason for choosing not to use contraception. The vast majority of women not intending to use contraception in the future instead cited reasons like side effects, health concerns, infrequent sex, and personal or moral opposition as reasons for not using family planning. Similar trends were evident in the 2008 Sierra Leone DHS and in other countries in Africa. Bongartz also made numerous references to contraception as a means to prevent unplanned pregnancies, or, equivalently, what contraception advocates outside of the Vatican grounds will often refer to as unwanted pregnancies. The notion unwanted births is antithetical to the Christian understanding of the human person, which values each and every individual as a unique and irreplaceable gift from God. The notion of an unplanned or an unwanted pregnancy as something to be avoided at all costs springs from a contraceptive mentality that cheapens the value of human life and the meaning of marriage. Rather than seeking to reduce population growth through artificial methods of contraception that pose hazards to women's health and cheapen the dignity of human life, the Church has always had a very different view. The Church has taught that couples should observe responsible parenthood through natural family planning methods such as NFP by having the number of children that they can reasonably expect to support physically, emotionally, and financially, not only with respect to their duties and family life, but also with respect to their duties to society at large. Yet couples are always to remain open to whatever new life God may choose to bring into the family regardless of the circumstances, for every life is valuable and has the right to be accepted. No price tag or socioeconomic indicator can be compared with the value of a single human life, and that's as it ought to be. This is PRI Review from pop.org. When we come back, we'll take a look at rogue judges in the United States and what the Congress can do about them. By now, we all know that Planned Parenthood is accused in the United States of allegedly violating the law by, among other atrocities, selling baby body parts. But what you might not realize is that Planned Parenthood's affiliates, Planned Parenthood Federation of America, PPFA, and International Planned Parenthood Federation, IPPF, are still getting away with murder overseas. Around the world, and especially in Latin America, the baby-killing giant shades the truth about its abortion-related activities. It runs roughshod over local anti-abortion laws and violates local pro-life sentiment, all with seeming impunity. But not anymore. With your tax-deductible gift, PRI will throw the book at the abortion giants overseas, just as pro-life groups are doing here at home. Did you know that PPFA spends about $38 million a year lobbying to legalize abortion in countries around the world? If they're successful, they can kill as many, if not more, babies overseas as they do in the United States. But there's a hitch. Because abortion remains illegal in most Latin American countries, neither IPPF nor PPFA is eligible for government funding for abortion-related activities as they are in the United States. So PPFA, IPPF, gets around it as only they know how to do, by lying. With a wink and a nod, they disguise the programs they are funding as, quote, education or health programs, women's right, human rights protection or promotion, and anti-discrimination initiatives aimed at protecting vulnerable groups such as women or LGBTs, that means lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender, end quote. Catholic bishops throughout Africa and Latin America complain about this. They call it ideological imperialism, but their voices are not heard in Congress because America's bishops depend on billions in government funding for their own charities. They don't want to bite the political hand that feeds them. Now, PRI receives no government funding, so we aren't hampered by golden handcuffs. That's why your tax-deductible gift to PRI is so important today. As the lead group investigating Planned Parenthood's activities overseas, PRI's Latin American office has uncovered PPFA's thinly disguised efforts to undermine pro-life laws and legitimate abortion on demand. But we've only found the tip of the iceberg, and there is more work to be done, work that we can't do alone. Your tax-deductible gift will help PRI hire a seasoned pro-life legal team to help us expose, investigate, and prosecute Planned Parenthood's affiliates everywhere they prey on women, especially overseas. Together, we'll expose, investigate, and prosecute PPFA and IPPF everywhere it tries to hide the truth. This two-prong attack, complementing the hearings taking place in Washington, will force Planned Parenthood to fight on two fronts. What better way to strike a blow against the real Planned Parenthood, the one we saw in all those horrific videos, than to come at them here and abroad? So please make a tax-deductible gift to support this and all of PRI's baby-saving efforts around the world. Yes, they're powerful. Yes, they're big. But remember, David and Goliath. The bigger they are, the harder they fall. In recent weeks, we have seen federal judges intervening in foreign affairs, marriage law, school bathroom privileges, and a host of other issues that are not the province of the courts, but of the executive or legislative branches of the federal government. And many, in fact, are reserved to the states and to the people. They are not any business of the federal government at all. The Constitution endows the federal government with certain express powers and no more. The 10th Amendment reserves to the state and to the people all other powers, most of which pre-existed the Constitution of 1787 in the first place. Of course, this is all news to today's law students and lawyers, all of whom stand in awe of the courts and consider their words, whatever the latest opinion might be, to be supreme indeed. Today, let's take a brief look at how this attitude has come to pass. Let's start with abortion. Right now, Planned Parenthood and other similar groups are bombarding the Senate with demands that senators defeat the president's nomination of Judge Neil Gorsuch to replace Justice Antonin Scalia on the Supreme Court. Since these are all single-issue groups, it's easy to perceive what their single issue is: unlimited abortion on demand. They perceive Judge Gorsuch as a threat, apparently because he might know something about the Constitution. For America's founders, the right to life was fundamental. In fact, it existed long before the Bill of Rights was written and was acknowledged in both the law and the culture. That's why the right to life is central to the argument made by Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence. But today, the courts have declared that they are no longer bound by Jefferson's laws of nature and of nature's God. With regard to the right to life, the courts simply cannot be trusted. And before calling that view extreme, consider there is ample precedent for that judgment. Let's review it briefly. New York Governor Charles Evans Hughes, before he became Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, affirmed 110 years ago that we are under a constitution, but the constitution is what the judges say it is. Now, to soften the radical character of that pompous assertion, he sugarcoated it with some happy talk. And the judiciary is the safeguard of our liberty and of our property under the Constitution, he added. Well, actually, Your Honor, the Constitution is the safeguard of our liberty and of our property. Every official and every branch of government swears an oath of office to uphold the Constitution, not the Supreme Court. Nowhere does a federal official swear to uphold the whims of what Antonin Scalia aptly called a committee of five unelected lawyers. But the Supreme Court thinks otherwise and has been pleased to arrogate to itself the august task of telling us what the Constitution says. In Cooper versus Aaron in 1958, a unanimous court made it clear. Article 6 of the Constitution makes the Constitution the supreme law of the land. I'm quoting here. In 1803, Chief Justice Marshall, speaking for a unanimous court, referring to the Constitution as the fundamental and paramount law of the nation, declared in the notable case of Marbury versus Madison that, and they're quoting herein, it is emphatically the province and duty of the judicial department to say what the law is, period, end quote. This decision declared that basic principle that the federal judiciary is supreme and the exposition of the law of the Constitution, we're continuing here now from the 1958 court case, opinion, and that principle has ever since been respected by this court in the country as a permanent and indispensable feature of our constitutional system, end quote. A brief aside here. The courts decide how a law applies to a certain case. It is the legislature that writes the laws, and thus, the legislature says what the law is. Well, the 1958 case brings us to the metaphysical level, or rather, to the denial of metaphysics altogether. If the laws of nature and of nature's God, that is, the natural law, no longer constrain the court's powers, what, beyond a capricious judiciary, is to protect our right to life? Los Angeles Archbishop Jose Gomez acknowledges America's Christian roots, but goes on to observe that, and I quote, our freedoms are also being eroded as the result of constant agitation from de-Christianizing and secularizing elements in American society, end quote. Now, unfortunately, those elements now dominate our legal system, where the dictatorship of relativism abounds in the robes of legal positivism. And with the destruction of metaphysics comes the destruction of limits. The denial of a natural order flows from what Augustine called the libido dominandi, the love of power, the hatred of limits on power. No one talks about that fundamental defect of pride these days for the very simple reason that in politics, virtually everybody suffers from it. So let's talk about it. And let's start with legal positivism. What is it? Well, this radical concept rests on the assumption that the law need have no basis in morality. In fact, it can't have a basis in morality because moral standards don't exist. This theory tells us that as long as the mechanics and procedures of the government and its agencies, courts, legislatures, and so on, are followed, their decision is above reproach since there is no higher law to appeal to. As PRI's longtime friend and board chairman Charles Rice, Notre Dame professor of constitutional law, has noted, Hans Kelsen, the father of legal positivism, observed that Auschwitz and the Soviet gulags were valid law. He could not criticize them as unjust because justice, he says, is an irrational ideal. End quote. Now, Kelsen had formulated his theory before the outbreak of World War II, but he survived the war. Did its horrors perhaps change his mind? Not at all. In fact, after the war, he could not condemn the murders of tens of millions because he insisted, according to the laws of the countries where they occurred, they were all legal. Kelsen's view holds not only for Hitler's Germany and Stalin's Soviet Union, but for America today. During the Senate hearings considering the nomination of Judge Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court, Judiciary Committee Chairman Joseph Biden repeatedly browbeat the nominee about the dangers of applying the natural law in American jurisprudence. You come before this committee with a philosophy different from that which we have seen in any Supreme Court nominee in the last 19 years, Biden sniffed. Now, what did Joe here find so different? It was simple. You are an adherent to the view that the natural law should inform the Constitution. End quote. Senator Patrick Leahy then asserted that the natural law is elastic, a notion which Biden seconded by alleging that his version of the natural law protects abortion rights. That's a stretch. But Judge Thomas would not engage that issue. He said merely that, I quote, my interest in the whole area was as a political philosophy, end quote, he told Biden. Well, Biden, Leahy, and Thomas are all Catholics. So is Justice Kennedy, who wrote in 1992 that at the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life, end quote. Unchained by reality, may I add. Now, clearly, current jurisprudence has sundered the courts from the true source of justice. They simply cannot be trusted. Senator Biden stated a simple fact. In his view, appeals to the natural law will fail in the Supreme Court, or they darned well better. And we can count on Senator Leahy and his Democrat colleagues to press Judge Gorsuch on the issue of natural law. Since Gorsuch actually studied at Oxford with Professor John Finnis, who has studied the natural law all his life. So Biden insists that natural law arguments must fail at the Supreme Court. Well, must they then fail in the Catholic Church as well? In his commencement speech at Catholic University in 2012, Timothy Cardinal Dolan, then president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, exulted, and I quote, that this university is both Catholic and American, flowing from the most noble ideals of truth and respect for human dignity that are at the heart of our church and our country, end quote. Indeed, ever since the efforts of Cardinal Gibbons 100 years ago, American prelates have labored to make Catholics good Americans. But today, the bishops, longtime supporters, collaborators, and beneficiaries of the federal government, have suddenly awakened to the fact that the government might have filed for divorce. And the grounds? The government, like Hans Kelsen, insists that truth and human dignity are irrational ideals. Clearly, like all Americans, Catholics have every right to demand that the courts respect the right to life. However, our positivist courts roundly reject the notion that they might have any responsibility to do so. The courts have revised the Constitution repeatedly over the years, and they are likely to do so again. After all, the Constitution is what they say it is. What cannot be revised, however, is humanae vitae. There, natural law and the teaching and the tradition of the Church combine to illuminate our troubled world with the brilliant saving light of eternal moral truth. Alas, it's a rare occasion indeed when a bishop ever mentions humanae vitae, at least en passant, in advocating the right to life. After all, the truth is still the truth, whatever the courts say it is. And Americans cannot count on a court that has abandoned metaphysics, the natural law, and the laws of nature and of nature's God. Clearly, since Engle v. Vitale, Roe v. Wade, and a host of other deleterious Supreme Court decisions, any sane person can tell that the Supreme Court, like Senators Biden and Leahy, has only contempt for the natural law. Now, Thomas Aquinas says that a bad law, lex mala, is no law at all, lex nulla. But for the Church formally to announce that fact as the basis for its refusal to obey a lex mala would bring on certain retaliation. Defunding of its welfare agencies, attacks on its tax exemption, abuse, derision, even persecution, driven by the cultural and political elites whose power relies on the progressive degeneration of our culture and the corruption of our politics. Persecution? Really? Professor Rice and the late Cardinal George of Chicago both warned that persecution will indeed come. But are we ready for it? The Constitution itself contains the best prescription for dealing with rogue judges. Let's look at what it says. Article 3, Section 2 gives the Congress the power to limit the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court and to restrict the classes of issues over which it now claims appellate jurisdiction. as Professor Rice testified to the House Judiciary Committee's Subcommittee on the Constitution in 1981, Congress can enact narrowly conceived and narrowly drawn exceptions to the appellate jurisdiction of the court in a particular class of cases without abolishing altogether the appellate jurisdiction of the court itself. It's quite clear that the Congress does have the power, he testified. In fact, 9 years earlier, my father, Clarence Mannion, former dean of Notre Dame's law school, wrote that the power of the Congress to restrict, control, and or abolish selected categories of the Supreme Court's appellate jurisdiction is unlimited. Since that time, 45 years ago, increasingly leftist professors in the field of law and political science have chided their students who dare to raise this issue. But all they can do is bluff, assuring the students that the Supreme Court would merely find such restrictions to be unconstitutional. Of course, such admissions are an admixture of wishful thinking and outright lobbying, but they also reveal the fear and the realization on the part of the legal profession that the Constitution plainly places such power in the hands of the legislature. Well, does our Congress, so riddled with special interests, have the backbone to take back its responsibility and use that power? We'll see. For now, what it boils down to in our own age is simply this. Today, the out-of-control judiciary has declared that the Constitution itself is simply unconstitutional. This has been PRI Review from pop.org. Thanks for listening.